do you want a career in science? And I said, yes, sir. Well, he said, if you do, you need to give up this naive faith in God because it will cripple you intellectually. You'll never make it. So give it up now in front of witnesses.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Professor John Lennox, you are well known as a debater. You're well known as an author and as a Christian apologist. But in reading your new book, My Story, which I immensely enjoyed, I discovered that more than any of those titles of author, debater, apologist, you're something else. You're an evangelist.
Well, I suppose that's right. In childhood, as a young boy, I became convinced that Christianity was true. That's the first thing. And second, that you can't keep it to yourself. That doesn't make any sense at all. And I suppose I really started sharing my faith when I got to Cambridge, although I'd done some things before, but as a student, it really blossomed and it's constantly been with me ever since.
Because there is a distinction, isn't there, that you can be an apologist and you can be an evangelist, but I think you have very much combined the two, and for you it's not just about answering objections for you.
You see, I don't actually like the word apologist or apologetics because it's a transliteration of a Greek word, it's not an English word. And it simply means defence. And I think Dr. Peter May's definition of it is the best I've seen, that apologia means persuasive evangelism. So there's no difference between the two. Answering questions and objections is, to a certain extent, a distortion. Paul's main apologia was his testimony. And in a pluralistic, multicultural society like we've got in the UK and elsewhere, you cannot open your mouth about the gospel without then facing a barrage of questions, and you have to deal with them and answer them. So I see no distinction whatsoever between evangelism and apologetics, except that we're defending the gospel in apologetics, but we're preaching it at the same time because defending it is proclaiming it.
The book is called My Story. You were a bit reluctant to write it, though, weren't you?
Oh, yes, because I don't like the word auto in autobiography, and that kept me back for quite a while, because talking about yourself is very risky, particularly for a Christian, when the central focus is not on ourselves, but on Christ and God. But what persuaded me in the end was reading Paul, at least Luke's account of Paul in Acts, where he comes back to Antioch from a missionary journey and he shares with the people at the church what, and I quote, what God had done with them. And it suddenly occurred to me that if I believe that my story is intimately bound up with what at least I believe God has done with me, surely I can share that with also the thought that perhaps I can share it in such a way as to be evangelistic. In other words, here's what I believe God has done with me. You judge it and see if that interpretation of my life makes sense to you. And then a large part of it is a story that has never been told before by me or anyone else, that I was the only one left to tell it. So many friends said, you must write this down before it's lost.
Yes, and I hope that by the end of this conversation, we might have a bit of a taste of that part of the story, which, as you say, has never been told before. And I have to say, was pretty mind-blowing in reading it. Certainly things that I had no idea about, and I'm someone who has followed a lot of your writing and speaking. So stay tuned for that. But here on the show, we always like to go back to the beginning and ask about a person's early life growing up. Now, you paint a picture in the book of growing up Northern Ireland, a loving Christian family, where perhaps contrary to some of the stereotypes of religious people, critical thinking was encouraged and was part of being a Christian.
It was very much so. And that's all the more interesting because my parents had no high level of education. My father was told to run a business that his father had, and he would love to have been educated, never got the chance. My mother taught commercial subjects, shorthand and typing, which was very advantageous because she taught all of her children, including me, to touch type as a boy, and that has been very useful. So that it was remarkable in a country rather ill-famed for its sectarianism that I had Christian parents who weren't sectarian and also who loved me enough to encourage me to think. And that fact has stayed with me all the time.
Yeah. The other story from your childhood I quite enjoyed reading was about your father, who wasn't keen on you having a TV. And I did wonder if we partly have him to thank for how that led to your intellectual life developing, because, of course, you couldn't spend any time in front of a television. You spent lots of time reading instead.
Well, that's partly true. What he did supply me with, other than the TV, which he eventually had a TV, but he got me a radio, which I still have sitting in the other room. And I listened to various, what I thought were individuals speaking, and I thought, this is very interesting. Can one get on the radio, so to speak? And that way I discovered amateur radio. And I was fascinated and became an amateur radio enthusiast and had my own transmitter in my home. And that opened up a whole new world, not only geographically, but I discovered it was a wonderful way of practicing and learning languages. And mathematics is a language. I've always been very interested in languages. But that instrument, spending time on that, meant I learned to speak pretty fluent French and then German after that. So that these were languages, particularly German, that I used.
Yes, and languages, again, has been a huge part of your life. Maths is a language. You mentioned French, German, obviously English. That takes us to four languages. How many other languages do you know?
Well, to varying degrees, Spanish and Russian on top of that.
Am I right in thinking you started tackling Biblical Hebrew at the young age of 80?
Yes, that's right. More or less, I promised myself to try it. And I wrote a book on Abraham, and I thought it would be very interesting to really concentrate and see if some knowledge of Hebrew would help. And it helped remarkably. I came across a very good course by Zondervan.
I want to take you forward slightly to your first encounter with a Nobel laureate, because this was quite shocking, but I think a good indication of some of what was to come in terms of you being tested in your faith and making a decision to stand up for it. This Nobel laureate basically told you to, quote, give up your childish faith in God. Just tell us the story of that encounter.
Well, it was a critical point, a turning point in a way. It happened because the college in Cambridge put on dinners, and the fellows had lovely meals every day, but we occasionally got invited to a nice dinner with them. And I found myself sitting beside this Nobel Prize winner. I always played Socrates, and still do all my life, asking people questions. So I plunged in and asked him about the research that he'd done to win the Nobel Prize. And then I said to him, while you were doing this, did it ever occur to you, when you discovered the intricacies of these processes, that there was a mind behind the universe? And he stiffened and he said no. And I think it was a little bit disingenuous. And the conversation finished. He wasn't going there. And I thought that was it. But at the end of the meal, he said, Lennox, come to my room, which was not an invitation, but a command. And I went, and to my surprise, he'd invited several other senior people. And as far as I recall it, they set me on a chair and they stood round. He said, now, do you want a career in science? And I said, yes, sir. Well, he said, if you do, you need to give up this naive faith in God, because it will cripple you intellectually. You'll never make it. And so give it up now in front of witnesses. which was enormous pressure. But what I said to him, I said, tell me, what have you to offer me that's better than what I have in Christ? Well, he said, there's the philosophy of Henri Bergson. Well, I knew about that because I'd read Lewis. And it was a very bad choice because Bergson actually thought of converting to Catholicism at one stage. It was a bad choice. And I said, if that's all you've got to offer me, I'll take the risk. I'll stay with Christ. And I got up and walked out. And that changed many things for me. It taught me a lot. The unacceptable face of academia, the misuse of academic authority and all the rest of it. And I made up my mind on the spot that if ever I got to the kind of position I'm in today as a professor at Oxford, I would never use my position to abuse anybody intellectually. And it did occur to me that if he'd been a Christian and I'd been an atheist, he'd probably have lost his job the next day for doing what he did. But such is the non-level playing field. And what I resolved to do was, as best I could, I want to put into the public space arguments for God and for Christ and let the people judge, give them the evidence. And that's what I've been doing for the rest of my life. But I suppose you're right. It was a preparation for meeting lesser intellect.
Excellent. Well, we'll come to that very soon. Again, in reading your book and looking certainly at your teens and your 20s, something people may not know about you is actually a real love, I think, for expository preaching, for Bible study. And this would then take you quite literally all over the world, but certainly all through Europe, all through the Soviet Union, speaking in churches, speaking at conferences, encouraging other Christians and going very deep. Was expository preaching your first love before the science and faith?
Very much so, and it still is in a way. In that I had a brilliant mentor who taught me how to think biblically and mentored me for nearly 50 years, which provided a very strong basis because I'd been publicly educated in science, mathematics and so on. And he was a classicist, Professor David Gooding, and a brilliant biblical scholar with a mind like C.S. Lewis. And he opened scripture to me. And I loved it from the word go because it appealed to my sense of order and logic. And it really embedded in my mind the importance of getting to see precisely what scripture says and its structure, logical and literary structure, before you delve into what it means. And I started sharing that with other students at Cambridge. The response was terrific. And that's what led to a public ministry, as you say, that's taken me all over the world. And I feel has produced the books that I wanted to produce. I'd love to have done a lot more, but I've done at least some. And my last book, the one you have in your hands, is my story, but the penultimate one is a book expounding Revelation, the final book in the Bible. And I still feel that God speaks through his word. And if we can build a bridge from scripture into culture, into our own academic disciplines, so that people can understand it better, that is my objective. Yeah.
So we're talking about two things, which I don't want to divide for reasons that will become clear. We're talking about an academic career at Cambridge. We're also talking about expository preaching and travelling. And the reason I don't want to divide those two is you're very clear in the book that a distinction between what's being called full-time Christian ministry versus ordinary secular work, that distinction is unbiblical. But it's a very pervasive way of speaking amongst Christians, isn't it? About, well, either you're in full-time ministry as a pastor or you're out there in secular work. Just explain what's wrong with that way of thinking.
Well, what it does is to divide life up in an unbiblical way. And I've been pursued by virtually every parachurch organization in the world. And people kept saying, you know, with your gifts, you ought to go full time. And I would listen to this. And then I would say, well, you're too late, actually. And they'd say, what do you mean you're too late? It's never too late to go full time. I say, you're not understanding me. I've been full time most of my life. And at the moment, what it looks like is this. I'm full time as a mathematician, as a husband, as a father, and later a grandfather. And all of this I do in the spirit of what Paul wrote to Colossians, whatever you do, not whatever Christian thing you do, whatever you do, do as unto the Lord. And often the reaction was, I didn't mean that. And I would say, oh yes, you did mean that. You've divided life into a kind of secular and sacred bit so that the top dogs are the full-time workers who are paid for by the second-class people, like myself. I said, that's thoroughly unbiblical. And what the Bible says is that we serve the Lord in all we do, or we ought to be, and that transforms life, because it means that God is not only interested in a Sunday morning. He's interested in your whole life, and it's in everyday life that we learn about the government of God. Because the famous statement, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you, is in the context of the motivation for daily work. And in the end, I wrote a book about it called A Good Return, Biblical Principles of Work, Wealth and Wisdom, because I feel this is such a pressure put on young people. And I meet them all the time and they said, look, I'm passionate about science or business or whatever. But people tell me if I really want to serve the Lord, I have to do it, quote, full time. And I think that is a very unacceptable pressure because it's not biblical. And people then get between young people and the Lord rather than leading them to the Lord so that they make their decision before him. Now, God will call people from normal employment to be, in that sense, supported by the church. He did so with some of the apostles. But Paul, you see, for example, he was in a very skilled job, that is tent making, which unfortunately we have borrowed to say, oh, it's just tent making to pay my expenses. No, it was a very skilled job, and all rabbis had to have a job. And that's a thing that we've lost, so that we now have a divide where he's paid to do the teaching and evangelism. I'm not. I'll fund it. But I never get involved in teaching and evangelism myself. And that's where the disaster happens, because only a small part of the church is mobilized. And you have ministers in churches and pastors desperate to get help. But their congregations have a mindset, we pay him to do it, so why should we? Rather than, what gifts and abilities have I got? Yeah.
And I think as well, in reading the book, you are able to be a very distinguished mathematician, scientist, to work in the academy. And you are also, it seems quite effortlessly at times, able to travel and preach. And I read the book and I thought, was it really so straightforward? Was there not more of a tension between, I don't know, your Monday to Friday job and your Saturday and Sunday travelling and speaking? You seem to be able to do both.
Oh, of course there was a tension. And it came to the point when I was in my early 50s that I thought that the part of my life which was teaching and defending the Christian gospel intellectually in the academy had to take precedence. And I felt that the mathematical world, I'd made my contribution such as it was. I was overburdened with far too much teaching, looking at the average in Britain, I just happened to be in Cardiff in a department which was had far fewer staff than its student numbers really reflected. And of course, there was no money. And that precipitated, it's a long and complex story, and I tell it there. I moved to Oxford. I came back into academia in Oxford and ended up with a chair, but it was on a totally different basis. And of course, it opened a much bigger world for me. So that is a complex story, but certainly there was a tension. People will see in the book, my wife prayed me out of Cardiff. And I leave the rest of that story to my readers.
You're also constantly telling the reader how supportive your wife has been throughout your ministry in doing so much while you've been away, travelling and speaking.
Before we got married, she really committed herself never to stand in the way of anything that the Lord had clearly called me to. And she's kept that magnificently, which is why the book's dedicated to her. And it wasn't easy, because some of my trips, I tried to contain them. But going to places like Eastern Europe, it tended to be a week or 2 weeks at a time, which is a long time for a woman to be left with three children and have to look after them and deal with all their falls and difficulties. But that kind of support, I couldn't have done it otherwise. And she supported me with the children way beyond what any person ought to be called to do, so to speak. So now that she's not well and disabled, it's my time to be at home and look after her, which I do gladly, because there is a sense in which life has come full circle and I need to learn these lessons. She cared for me, I need to learn how to care for her.
I'm really keen to talk about the part of the book that is brand new, that has never been shared publicly before. It involves your work in the Soviet Union, both before and after the fall of the Berlin Wall, really. I understand from the book you even have a piece of the Berlin Wall.
I do indeed. Well, to put it more accurately, before 1989, my travels to the East were really confined to the Iron Curtain and just beyond. So we're talking about Hungary, Poland, and the German Democratic Republic. It was only after 1989, when the communism collapsed, that I started going to Russia and then to Ukraine, most of all. Here I was, an academic in employment in Cardiff University, first of all, speaking fluent German and travelling mostly on my own behind the Iron Curtain. So
it's a bit suspicious.
And from a practical point of view, my colleagues would never have understood it. It was very intense, some of it. I often left Cardiff on a Friday or a Thursday night if I could get away with it, and did 12 hours maybe Bible teaching in some country and was back on Monday by Monday morning, which is pretty intensive. But I just found that it was wiser to keep quiet about it. And I didn't talk about it much in churches, because it was of a nature that not a great deal of interest was shown in it. Sadly, in a way, some people were interested, and I had prayer support in that way. So I didn't talk about it. And the events in Russia that I witnessed and all the rest of it, they were just too complex. And of course, I, at the time, didn't think enough of them to make a proper record. But we'd formed a little trust to actually distribute the writings of David Gooding in many languages. And that formed the basis for some of our travels, which meant there were minutes. And so quite a bit of that book I managed to recover from the minutes and my own meagre diaries and recollections and all the rest of it. And I just feel now that and with some many friends saying, look, you've got to tell this story because it's a story about what God has done. And it's almost unbelievable to me, looking back, that all these things happened.
There's lots to pick up on. One of them is when you're in a hotel room and you basically pick up, you think you might be being listened to.
Oh, I was listened to. It was quite obvious. The particular event you're thinking about happened in what used to be called Karl-Marx-Stadt, now Chemnitz, its old name, in East Germany. And I stayed in Hotel Moscow, which was a huge Stalin-esque hotel, and several times I was given exactly the same room to stay in. And when you went in through the door, there was a kind of blinding flash in the lock, and a few moments later in the room the telephone began to hum. And it was really hilarious. One night this telephone was annoying me. I was trying to sleep and there at my head was going buzzing, so I picked up the receiver and spoke in German, of course, and said, good evening, gentlemen. I don't talk in my sleep, at least I don't think I do. In any case, it won't be interesting. And I'm sure you'd like some sleep. I certainly would. So why don't you just switch it off? Let me go to sleep. And they did. It went off. And I managed not to be bothered by such things, but I did notice that some people who from time to time came with me were very bothered and couldn't cope with that. The idea of being followed, spied on, all the rest of it. And I was spied on a lot, as I discovered subsequently, not always at the time.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99.
I mean, just for those who don't understand this, can you set the context, perhaps for those who are a little bit younger? So, well, why would anyone be interested in spying on you? What's the background here?
Well, it varied from country to country. Hungary was the most open of the countries, even in that time. So much so that when East Germans got permission to go to Hungary, they thought they'd really come to paradise. I remember people telling me that. But the communist authorities were very worried about Western political criticism. And I knew for a fact that sometimes visiting Christians from the West who were given an opportunity to speak to a Hungarian audience really were very unwise and started criticizing the government and all the rest of it, even though they knew nothing of what was going on. Yeah. And of course, I was aware of all of this, and I actually spent a fair bit of time talking to Christian leaders and saying, look, I will come if you want me to, but I don't have to come. And secondly, I will look to you for guidance as to what's appropriate and what isn't, because I will probably be allowed to leave, whereas you have to stay. And they told me, some groups, that they'd never had anybody say that to them. And so I learned a great deal. And there was one incident in Hungary where the church leaders were called in to the police, and they were told that they must never allow a certain person to speak again. They come in and started upbraiding the communist government. And then they said, why don't you ask Dr. Lennox again? Because we know him and he's okay. So there were people listening.
Yeah.
In East Germany, it was more serious because there were very few people with my kind of education who were Christians, because they had a ceremony, which I describe in the book, which was intellectual murder in my view, where young people at the age of 13 or so had to make a public declaration of commitment not only to the state but to the atheistic state. And if they didn't do that, as some didn't, because they were believers, they were not allowed any further education. So I was suspect, and therefore it was clear that I was being monitored and all this kind of thing. And people that showed interest in me would be monitored. But amazingly, for all those years, I went many times. And I didn't carry Bibles in and that kind of thing. They wanted me in to talk about the Bible, first of all. I mean, all those early visits were Bible teaching and occasionally sharing things about how you could believe in God as a scientist, but they were mainly expounding scripture because they got so little of it.
You again write about this incredible spiritual hunger for Bibles, hunger for teaching. The waiter in a hotel who noticed you were reading a Bible and asked you about it.
That, I think, was in Ukraine, in Kyiv. And he stood there, a humble-looking man in his 60s or so, and he said, "Sir, is that a Bible you're reading?" I said, "Yes." "Oh," he said, "I'd love to have a Bible. When will you be next on duty?" So he told me. And I got a New Testament for him, in Ukrainian. I knew some people got one, gave it to him. And I could see two things, joy and disappointment. I said, "What's the matter?" "Well, oh, sorry," he said, "I'm so pleased to have this. But I'd love to read the stories of Abraham and David." And my heart just went out to them. I said, "Just sit here." And I went up to my room and I got my Russian Bible, gave it to him, and he stood there weeping. And I tried to pay him for the breakfast, but he wouldn't hear of it in the hotel. And things like that, they really go to your heart. And there were many incidents which I described where I saw the hunger. And here we are in the West, many of us, with many Bibles on our shelves and all the rest of these people, with very little access either to the Bible or to Christian literature and so on. So, you know, it was an immense privilege to do that under those circumstances.
And another remarkable part of this story is the books and the Christian literature that you were involved in distributing. 750,000 books distributed in Russia.
Basically, it is that I managed to do some lectures and write some articles in the newspaper of the Academy of Sciences, and then in the teacher's newspaper with my colleague David Gooding. And those articles were put into books and sent out to teachers and so on. And eventually, because of the collapse of communism, there was a huge moral vacuum which serious educators realized. And they needed a book to go into the schools that somehow taught people a foundation for ethics and morality. And we were approached at the end, or I saw it, Newsweek, this appeal from the Russian Ministry of Education. I talked to David Gooding and we thought we could do something. And that's led to a series on the Bible and ethical education in schools. But in the end, we were asked, could we possibly write a book? And what developed was the notion of writing a book on worldview so that it could go into classes and be taught by teachers, because it presented a series of worldviews, representative ones. And of course, one was materialism, Marxism. Another one was based on Buddhism, Far Eastern religion, and then there were various other modifications, postmodern attitudes, and the Christian worldview. And we justified the inclusion of that by the fact that we were giving a palette. That's the first thing. The second thing is, and the authorities loved this and told us, that it was not a confessional book, because what that means is it wasn't pushing a denomination. But it was teaching people to think. And what we discovered was that, unfortunately, Marxism had a habit of stopping people thinking. It was learning by rote in virtually every discipline. And so the teachers were now faced with having a book, but they didn't know how to use it because they'd never been allowed to teach people to think. And that caused a great number of visits on our part, which were fascinating, thrilling, in fact, to Russia, but particularly to Ukraine, where we'd go for a long weekend and have maybe 100 teachers, senior teachers, who are called methodologists, who had responsibility for 50 or 60 or maybe more teachers themselves. How they coped with their work and all of that, I don't know. And we sat with them over a long weekend, intensively discussing how you teach young people to think. That was a huge privilege. I mean, yeah. Utterly remarkable that that happened. Yeah. And the books were turned out, three volumes in the end. And they're now actually in English, years and years after they were used. There's a series of six books in the Myrtlefield House imprint. And those can actually be downloaded from the internet.
And you can sort of trace a line and see how your experience in Russia, your experience of communism, Marxism, atheism, was sort of laying the foundation for the next part of your life, where you would be tackling atheism back here in the UK and in the West as well. And you write that from the perspective of the communist state, the only significance or value a person has was their work. This provided a real insight into an atheist value system that demeaned humanity. It is also a salutary warning, since the same kind of attitude is increasingly evident in the West, where the transcendent value that the Judeo-Christian worldview assigns to human beings, that they are made in the image of God, is rapidly being lost. You're arguing there that communism didn't value people once they couldn't work, and you're concerned that that same devaluing of the intrinsic worth of human beings is actually being lost in the West.
Yes, it's essentially a materialistic reductionism. And people over there used to joke with me and say, you know, in the West, you're as materialistic as we are in the philosophical sense. The only difference between us is you have the material. There's a lot of truth in that. And that's right. Work is a very important part of life, as Genesis teaches us, but it's only part of life. And the tragedy of aspects of communism, the worker state or the worker paradise and all the rest of it, was that it reduced humanity to a working thing. And once finished, well, let's get rid of them as quickly as possible.
There's a number of times in the book, there's a couple of trips to Israel, but there's also encounters with Jewish people all over the world. And there's one particularly touching story when you're in Hungary and you're being shown around a synagogue in Budapest, and you fall into conversation with a woman from South America. She was researching her family background, including relatives who had died in the Holocaust. So you're in this synagogue with her. You've never met her before, but you strike up a conversation. You actually begin to translate for her some of what was happening on the tour.
Well, that's right. She was searching for her roots. And I often visited synagogues because I fell into conversation with people. But it was a dramatic encounter because the synagogue had an exhibition of two things. One was the festivals of Israel, starting with Pesach, Passover, and ending up with the Feast of Tabernacles around the room. And I was chatting to her about the meaning of these things, but adding a little bit to what the rabbi was saying because of the fulfillment of, say, Passover in Jesus, just very gently and so on. But I hadn't noticed until we got to the middle that in the center of the room there was a doorway, and it was a replica of the gate of Auschwitz, where I'd been many times. Arbeit macht frei, work sets you free. And behind it was a horrific photo montage of the experiments that Josef Mengele had done on twins in Auschwitz. And the doorway wasn't very wide because it was a montage, and she put out her hands and stood in the form of a cross in the doorway and raised her voice up and says, "And what does your religion make of this?" Because she'd realised I was a Christian by that time. And everybody stopped, you see. So I wondered, well, what do we do now? But I took up that challenge because I felt it was important. And I simply said, you know, I would not want to insult the memory of your relatives who perished in the most horrific Holocaust that we all know about that is represented by this. And I said, what I'm going to say is, will be quite difficult for you, because you know from what I've said earlier that I believe that Yeshua is the Messiah. But I said, just try and come with me. The central claim of what I hold to is that God became human in Yeshua. Now, just hold with me. I know it's very difficult for you to imagine that, but just think of what implication that would have if it were true. This is God in human form on a cross. What is God doing on a cross? And I said, surely it shows us that God has not remained distant from human suffering, but has himself become part of it. And at that point, she started to weep, and she still had her hands outstretched. And she said, why has no one ever told me that about my Messiah before? It was very dramatic. And I've had that experience multiple times with the same story, that the hardest problem that we all face, whatever worldview, is the problem of pain and suffering, and especially the moral suffering of people doing wicked and cruel things to each other. And the fact that God enters our suffering and raised Jesus from the dead, those two things putting together, if he just suffered and died, we'd never have heard of him. But the fact that God raised him from the dead is where the hope begins. And I explained that to her as best I could. And it's one of those encounters that just stays with you. I can see her right now still, as many years ago, that this is part, Sam, of a supernatural dimension. And, of course, in my writings on science and God, I point out that science does not have any way of ruling out a supernatural dimension. And I think that some of the things that I've experienced are certainly evidence.
Now, I want to come on famously to some of your debates. You have debated the most well-known atheists in the world, including Richard Dawkins, particularly following his infamous book, The God Delusion, which was remarkably popular around 2006 when it was first published. I mean, do you think that the rise of what was then called New Atheism, Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens and others, it inadvertently actually led to a lot of evangelistic opportunities? I was interested to read that actually following your first debate with Dawkins, you were actually quite unwell, and this seemed to be a bit of a pattern. It happened on another occasion as well.
It is odd that looking back, because it was only a short time afterwards I nearly died. My right coronary artery occluded and was completely blocked, and they just managed to save my life, and I didn't have the heart attack that would have taken me away. And it was just quite staggering, even to the doctors who operated. They told me when they finished that I should be dead. And if I'd survived, I would have had about a 5% quality of life. And then he said, look, your heart isn't even damaged. I put a stent in, you can go home tomorrow. Quite a remarkable thing. That's right. Whether there's any connection or not with the stress, the preparation for that debate was a huge effort, because I take these things very seriously, because it was very obvious to me, I didn't seek it, that this was new ground And in a sense, the gospel would be on trial. I couldn't avoid that. And so much trepidation and a lot of hard work went into that. And possibly the stress contributed to it. I just don't know. The encouraging thing is that over the years since that debate with Dawkins, I get letters from people who got converted through it. I mean, through watching it on YouTube and so on, where it still sits.
Amazing. Amazing. I'm sure you're aware, you have been compared with C.S. Lewis. I thought that might be your reaction. Is it not a fair comparison?
Well, Lewis was a genius. I'm not a genius. I listened to Lewis in Cambridge, and I owe him a huge amount.
But you could argue that C.S. Lewis was the foremost apologist or defender.
Oh, absolutely.
You could say the same of yourself.
No, I would not think evaluations like that don't sit too well with me. They're for others to make. But, you know, sometimes I say that if I can see anything, it's only because I stand on very tall shoulders. And Lewis supplied two of them. In particular, I've no idea what it's like to be an adult and not a Christian. And I needed to understand just what make atheists tick. And I've done that in two ways, one by reading people like Lewis and the other by talking to people who do not share my worldview. And that attitude of seeking out people that don't share my worldview has been with me all of my life. And it was the clarity of Lewis's logic and the fact that though he wasn't a scientist, he did understand the philosophy of science and how it works a lot better than many scientists I meet. He saw where the real issues were. And these days, of course, moving into the IT, the technological age, his prescience in his two books, The Abolition of Man and That Hideous Strength, that has been enormously helpful to me in my writing. If you get angry or start ad hominem arguments, you've lost the plot completely. And I go out of my way to try to befriend them, to understand why are they so angry? Why are they? And sometimes people see that and they respond much better. And friendship, respect, doesn't mean that you have to compromise with truth. I mean, Paul puts it brilliantly, speaking the truth in love. You could show affection even to people without compromising truth. And that's what I've tried, with God's help, to do. I'm encouraged by the fact that people sometimes move very slowly, incrementally. And we've seen more recently people of that intellectual stature and higher moving visibly towards the Christian faith. Tom Holland, Ian McGilchrist, and so on. And so I feel that all of that is useful, but the journalist who advised me not to try to outwit Hitchens made a very important point. He said, you go into that debate, you have a message. Don't let Hitchens shift you from getting across the message you have for the audience out there. And that is very important, because if you just reacted to someone like him, you would never get across what you yourself believe. And so I realize that it's a platform. It would be wonderful if Dawkins ended up like Saul of Tarsus and got converted, and I pray for him. But there's an audience out there that listens and weigh the evidence. And I'm so encouraged by the folks who've been converted through all of these debates and still continue to be. Everybody's an individual. And people often ask me, what is the best answer to this question? I said, there isn't one. It depends who's asking it. And that's crucially important, to listen to people. I was taught as a boy that I got two ears and one mouth, that I should probably use them in that proportion. But to listen to them, because people are very different. For some of them, intellectual arguments about God, the existence of God, the historicity of Jesus and so on, they're hugely important. Others, will it change my life? Can Jesus give me meaning? That's what they're after.
That was Professor John Lennox speaking to me, Sam Hales, here on Premier Christian Radio. It was a privilege to travel to Oxford and meet John and capture that interview. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you want more from John, then do check out his book. It's called My Story. It's published by SPCK. And I do wholeheartedly recommend you get a copy and hear more of John's story. The other way you can hear more from John is actually getting the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. John is our cover story this month and contains some great photos in that article we captured whilst at his home in Oxford. So do go to premierchristianity.com. You can read my interview with John Lennox there and also get hold of the print magazine with loads of fantastic content for you this month on everything from climate change to spiritual growth to Jeremy Clarkson's TV show, Gardening for God, and what Gen Z want from church. It's all in Premier Christianity magazine, so head to premierchristianity.com now. Thank you so much for joining us on The Profile today. If you want to hear more interviews like this, just search for The Profile on Premier Plus or wherever you get your podcasts from. Have a great rest of your weekend. Take care.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity magazine.